Hello, hello, and welcome to episode 12 of Launch and Learn. In this podcast, we talk to entrepreneurs about their experiences in starting and launching startups. This podcast is hosted by Matthias Dickerhoff and Alexander Thompson. Today, we have Julian and Sebastian on as guests, who co-founded AirGreets, which offers professional and complete management of Airbnb rentals. Earlier this year, they sold the company, and recently they both joined the corporate venture builder Striber as associate partners. They will share their entrepreneurial experiences, talking about areas like hiring a CTO as non-techies, market expansion, and building trust with consumers.
Cool. Thanks, guys, for coming on the podcast. This is our first time with two people at once, so we'll see how it goes. But it's really exciting to have you guys on.
Thank you very much for having us.
Really excited to be on this.
As usual, we'll start with what each of you had for lunch today.
So because we knew you were going to ask that question, we went to lunch early today so that we could fit it in here. But then we had Korean food, which was delicious. But Sebastian said it's probably not a good idea to have meat before a podcast where we have to disclose what kind of lunch we have, because everyone here is quite a militant vegan or vegetarian. So I'm not sure if we made that many friends with that answer. But it was delicious food. What can I say?
Yeah. Can't go wrong with Korean.
Can never go wrong with Korean. That's right.
Yeah, so usually we start with a bit of background, how you guys kind of got interested in an entrepreneurship in the startup scene in the first place. So maybe just each of you can explain maybe your start, like education, your experience, and why you got interested in entrepreneurship.
Cool. So I can start with that. So I got first exposed to the startup world through my friends very early on. So I had a few friends in high school or just after high school who had their own businesses. And that really made me interested in what these guys were doing day in and day out. So I just kept my interest high in entrepreneurship throughout my studies. Always been very interested in building stuff and having impact. So I started reading startup news very early on, attended entrepreneurship classes during my MBA. And yeah, just really, really stayed interested in general. And then when it came to AirGreets in the specific case, we were just very, very interested in solving a real world problem that we had ourselves.
Yeah, what about you, Julian?
Yeah, so for me, it's different, actually. I was never too exposed to startups or the startup world at all. So I was studying finance, and then I went into strategy consulting, and was kind of very much focused on the corporate side of things and never really exposed to startups and didn't really read much about it, didn't really know much about it, to be honest. But just got really excited at some point about doing something and creating something and starting something. So that's kind of how we came about it. And to be honest, I, on my part, went into it quite naively, not knowing much about anything, really, just wanting to do something, wanting to create something. I'm glad I had Sebastian with me who can show me the ropes a little bit and teach me a thing or two.
And before jumping into the whole, AirGreets, how did the two of you actually meet?
So we've known each other for quite a long time now. We went to primary school together. We didn't go to the same kindergarten, even though we lived quite close, but Sebastian went to the crappy alternative kindergarten for me. It was a local rival. Literally, they were right next to each other, but we never spoke. But went to the same primary school and were in the same class. So at some point we had to bury the hatchet and decided that we'd become friends. And we were quite close friends for most of primary school and high school as well. And actually started our first business together when we were, I think, 8 years old. We were knitting stuff and selling it to our neighbors. And the profit margins were incredible, because at some point our neighbors started to pay us for not knocking at their doors anymore, which is, of course, incredible. The scalability of that model was a bit of a question, and we gave it up at some point because we didn't make that many friends. But we have very young entrepreneurial experience. It wasn't VC funded or anything. Yeah, so
okay. Very cool. And how did you go from that experience and then starting AirGreets in 2016?
So we after we finished high school, we lost touch a little bit, even though we were still doing relatively similar things and we were studying relatively close to each other. We both studied business, both went into consulting. Kept in touch, of course, but not as close as before anymore. But then as we both got excited about the idea of starting a business, we got closer and closer again and started talking about it. For me personally, it was So I was on the normal kind of consultant track. And for me, it was the point in time where I had to decide, do I want to do an MBA with my consultancy and then sign up for a few more years after coming back from MBA again and kind of taking the long-term consultant track. And I was actually very close to going that route until we came across the idea for AgReads, and then everything changed quite quickly. And I resigned very soon after. And that idea came about when I was on an office transfer to the Los Angeles office of my consultancy and was just taking a trip up the coast of California with my girlfriend for a week or so. And we went from Airbnb to Airbnb, spent quite good money at those Airbnbs, and just seeing our hosts, seeing the people that were renting to us, just looked to me like they're making money so easily and quite a bit of money so easily. Why have I never myself rented out my place when I was a consultant, traveling frequently, traveling every week with an expensive flat in London that I used for literally only half the year because the other half I was somewhere in a hotel, somewhere far away. And I relatively quickly realized, okay, that wouldn't have been that easy, right? Because you kind of have to be there to manage it. What if some guests lock themselves out in the middle of the night and then they call you and you're in a hotel in Copenhagen, you can't really help, right? Also, if you work long hours, you don't really want to take care of kind of talking to guests and replying to requests or anything. And you definitely, if you come back on a Thursday, Friday night, late after a tough week of work with not a lot of sleep, you don't want the first thing you have to do is to clean your apartment, right? So we thought surely there's a business and there's a market and there's demand for a solution that we then built with AgReads, which kind of combined a technical solution that automated a lot of the things around hosting that were possible to automate. So kind of the listing creations on platforms like Airbnb and so on, as well as guest communications, yield management, all of that. And then combine that with a network of cleaning companies on the ground that could deal with cleaning the apartments that we rented out after they'd been rented out, to then get them ready for the next guests as well. And that's how AgReads was created. So what we really did is help people rent out their apartments, their flats, their homes, hassle-free, and make money off of that.
And once you had this idea, what was kind of the first thing you did? Like, did you talk to people? Did you do prototyping? What was kind of the process to get started?
So yeah, as Julie mentioned, we just got out of consulting, both of us. And we were kind of the perfect target group for our service. We were trying to solve a problem that ourselves had, right? So the first thing we did was we went back to our consultancies and talked to all the friends and ex-colleagues that we made from our time in consulting and said, look, you guys are in a very similar situation. You guys have a nice apartment in downtown locations. You are away for most of the week. If you spend a weekend at your project location, you're even gone for 2 weeks in a row. Your apartment is sitting empty at home. Why don't you put that up to work and make some money out of it, right? So we really tried to be very, very customer-centric from the first days onwards. Talked a lot to potential customers, to potential hosts of our service, and then started developing the product in terms of, so we had a bit of a two-sided product. One was really the services offering. So which services to include was very crucial to talk to the people to understand which services they really needed. And then we had a technological product that was supporting all the information flow, but also the front end towards the customer. So we had, we started inputting the calendar into our digital product and billing information and all that kind of stuff that the customers, our hosts, could actually use in order to get started with AgReads. So that's basically how we started, really just talk to people who we thought might be interested in our product and then took it from there and developed it.
Bullied a few friends into being our first customers as well.
Yeah, and not charging any money, of course, for the very first customers.
And that might be interesting as well, cleaning the flats ourselves in the beginning, right? So we were literally doing everything in the beginning. In the beginning, it was a super manual offering and super manual process and product, right? I mean, we were sitting there, we were answering guest requests, and we were the ones going into apartments, cleaning them. And that was, of course, that was quite a change from the work we had 1 month before, right? Yeah. But it was good. I think it served us well and helped us to the very end to just know what it's like, right? Know what it's like to be there, how much time you really need for things, and just understand all the processes inside out.
Yeah, because we were switching to a more of a partnership model when it came to on the ground tasks over time. And for that, it was absolutely necessary for us to really understand each and every single step of the process mm-hmm. that is happening on the ground in order to outsource it and give it into the hands of other people. And also understanding, of course, how much time they should need to clean an apartment, for example, or to do a guest check-in or to do a preparation of an apartment mm-hmm. In order to make the unit economics work at some point.
And building the first MVP, did you guys have an internal tech team for that, or do you guys do it yourself somehow?
So for the very first tech product, we worked with an agency, which was an all right experience, not the best we ever had. And that is
phrasing it very diplomatically.
Very diplomatically. But then we brought a CTO in relatively quickly who set up the IT infrastructure and also his own IT team. So at the end, when we sold the company, beginning of this year, we had a team of 4 developers doing back-end, front-end, and all the infrastructure work.
Yeah, it's cool. You guys are like kind of democratizing property management so that anybody can just like can run that as a...
In some ways, and that was kind of the motivator for it all as well, right? You spend such a huge percentage of your income, of your monthly income on rent or on a mortgage, whatever it may be, right? Mm-hmm. It's insane. And by far the biggest asset we have as individuals is often our home, right? But it's completely underutilized because we don't use it during the day. I mean, now we do because of Corona, but we didn't used to use it during the day really, except for on weekends. And for many people, we're using it less and less on a nightly basis as well, right? So if you think about how much time of the 168 hours that you have a week, you actually spend in your apartment when you're paying for the full 168 hours, that gets distorted more and more and less efficient more and more, right? So we wanted to produce a solution that could help with that.
And with 2 founders, like how did you split up the tasks like early on in the business? So you kind of knew who was responsible for what, or was it a lot of like overlap between your responsibilities?
No, we had a very clear setup. So Julian was taking care of all the operations, and that includes all the partnership management of the local partners that do the on-site services and the investor relations part. And I was taking care of all things growth and product. So performance marketing, content marketing, sales, product from a business perspective together with the CTO.
And talking about investor relations, so did you start just like by yourself bootstrapped, or did you have some investment early on?
So we started, I think it was the first 4 months, maybe it was our own money for the very limited expenses we had at that time. Mm-hmm. And just to prove a little bit that it works, right? And to prove the groundwork and so on. But we got angel investment in relatively quickly then, just from a group of kind of the typical friends and family or friends of friends kind of setup, which gave us a bit more flexibility.
And going from, you know, having your friends and family using your product to actually scaling that to, you know, expanding that into different markets, how was that like from a growth perspective? Do you use certain channels and methods for that?
So from a customer acquisition point of view, it was very challenging. So we always found out that, you know, there's a few people you can get through word of mouth, but you have to really find a scalable channel to reach your growth targets. And that was quite a challenge. So we did quite some experiments on performance marketing, using Facebook and Instagram ads. Scaled our service relatively quickly to different cities and also different countries. And we noticed quite some differences between the cities and especially the countries when it came to channel acquisition channels. And yeah, we were experimenting a lot and try to make the customer acquisitions work in the unit economics formula, and we're adding a few more channels around content. So our product is very heavy in explaining to customers because it's basically another level on top of an existing landscape around Airbnb and booking.com, etc. So it was a new product. We had to explain a lot. We had to talk a little bit about the regulatory environment in Germany as well when it came to short-term letting, and all of that was done within the marketing department and helped us eventually grow to over 1,000 homes that we were managing.
Yeah, and I mean, part of this growth is obviously adding people to your team as well. And you mentioned having a CTO. How did you manage that hiring process, like between the two of you? And what did you look for when you're hiring your first employees?
So we were, I mean, getting the right people was, as it always is, especially on the technical side, a challenge, right? Especially the CTO. It took quite a while until we found the right person there, but finally got there, thankfully. And he then helped with, well, he drove most of the buildup of his team, of the developer team, to be honest. With the rest of the team, because we were in some ways quite an operations heavy team, right? So we had quite a few people who were doing things like guest communication, customer service, and so on, and overlooking these fields, as well as, of course, the expansion to, as Sebastian mentioned, quite a few cities quite quickly, required us to have people on the ground there as well, right? But what we looked at when we were hiring people was probably three things. We didn't look so much at what university did you go to, or things like that. I think for us, what was really important, because we were at the stage where we started hiring strongly, still a very young organization without maybe the perfect processes in place, and of course quite a bit of growth. So we were really looking for people who could prove to us that they would show strong ownership when they got into their role. And what I mean by ownership is just, I mean, feeling responsible for not only for the things that someone tells you to do, but kind of the things that are one step removed from it, that maybe only you see is a requirement to get involved in, and no one else sees. And if you don't do it, no one's going to do it, and it's going to fall off the table somehow and get ignored, right? So we're really looking for people who had that entrepreneurial mindset and who were passionate about what Airgrids was and what Airgrids' mission was, passionate about the customers and the guests, in order to make sure that we delivered to a standard that we wanted to deliver. Right, that was one of the things. The other thing was just what we wanted in people was a good level of overall business judgment, just understanding what their input and their work meant for the wider organization. Right, so really understanding. Kind of having a feeling for the fact that if you talk to a customer who has several apartments and who we make quite a bit of revenue with, that is maybe someone you should prioritize. I mean, it's basics like that, but also maybe a bit beyond that, thinking about, okay, I'm sticking to the processes here that have been defined, but maybe we can make some improvements here because I've seen that this and this happens and this has this and this impact, and I'm kind of aware of the unit economics and what that means for the overall profitability of the company. So we wanted to have people who understood that as well and went there. And I think one of the things that we were passionate about early on as well was getting a good level of diversity into the team, right? I mean, we were three dudes founding it, right? So it wasn't a great start, to be honest. But from there, we tried to build up quite a diverse team in terms of the different backgrounds, and we're pretty successful at that. I mean, we had maybe 20, 22 full-time people, and I think 9 nationalities represented or something like that. So, and that's what made it quite exciting. That's one of the things that I'm really proud of. I think to have built a team that is really, really aligned on one mission and really, really passionate about what we do and really close to each other as well, but from very different backgrounds.
Regarding your CTO, I assume you guys don't have so much technical background. How did you, find that CTO? Like, do you have certain criteria, and what sort of helped you make that decision for that individual?
Yeah, so what you're saying there is that was a huge problem, right? And we that's maybe one of the things we should have seen a bit earlier. Then if you want to build a startup, probably good to have someone on your founding team who's a developer, who can be the CTO, right? And that was... there's maybe one key learning going forward, quite an obvious one, but one we had to make first. But in terms of the process, Sebastian, maybe you can talk to it.
As I mentioned earlier, we were working with that agency in the very early days of our product development, and we had quite a good understanding of what the tech landscape is supposed to look like in a mid or long term perspective. So we knew what we were looking for, and we looking for not just a CTO, but someone who could really develop the entire IT infrastructure, really have ownership of that entire team, build up the team as well. And we were of course, also ready and willing to incentivize him accordingly in terms of, you know, giving him shares and really making him feel part of the extended founding team. So that really helped us in testing not only his technical skills and background, but also his, you know, willingness to invest into Agreets, invest a lot of time and enthusiasm and emotion. Kind of how we got to filling up that CTO position.
Going back to one of your statements was that, you know, talking about cities and countries, where did you actually start? In what city? And did you have a strategy to expand to the different cities and countries?
Yeah, so we started in Munich and Frankfurt, because that's where Sebastian and our third co-founder were located, A, and B, that's where we thought the best markets in Germany for our service potentially were, based on a combination of factors, but mostly kind of what we thought about what demand there might be and what the unit economics might look like, both from an income and from a cost perspective. That's where we started, expanded really quickly into the next four biggest German cities, so Berlin, Hamburg, Cologne, and Düsseldorf. Berlin was kind of the latest addition because of regulatory changes that needed to happen before we could offer our service there, and so expanded to those cities really quickly. The idea behind it was to just very quickly build up a dominant position in the German market and make sure that none of the competitors that there were internationally, both in Europe and beyond, wouldn't be too keen in entering the German market if they see a dominant player there. And to be honest, until this day, I still don't know if that was the right decision or not, because we, of course, spread ourselves relatively thin. What that meant was that there was a lot of times where I got on a train kind of in the middle of the night to be in a new city tomorrow to kind of make sure things were going all right there. And this was the very, very early days when we basically hadn't hired many people. And that, of course, meant that things like Sebastian spoke to marketing earlier, right? And how we had a certain threshold of kind of creating awareness and creating a brand before we could really sell our business to our customers. And that's, of course, harder if you do that in six cities and later even 8-9 cities in three countries, rather than, say, only focusing on Munich. Maybe the right strategy would have been to only focus on Munich for quite a while, right? I don't quite think so, but that's kind of one of the questions that we, in all honesty, haven't quite figured out yet, which the right way was or would have been. Yeah.
And you mentioned like the different regulations kind of in each city with Berlin and stuff, and I'm sure like across countries as well, there's a lot of different markets and landscapes. How did you guys navigate that, like in the prop tech industry?
Yeah, so regulation was one of the most dominant factors that we thought about very, very often, and that we talked about very often to investors, for example, as well. What made our market a bit tricky is that the regulation around short-term rentals is a very, very local set of rules. So every city can basically come up with whatever they want to do. Right. In general, it was the case that Germany had much, much stricter rules and regulations around the whole topic than other countries. What that meant was that early on, we were focusing on renting out primary homes. So homes where people actually lived in, but were away for, say, often a few weeks at a time, or the way we were away kind of during the week as consultants and so on. So really focus on homes that weren't taken away from the overall rental market and that were only rented out when the guy or girl living in it wasn't there, right? Because the spirit of the regulation was often exactly that. Don't take away apartments that would usually go to the rental market, to the long-term rental market, and rent them out short-term, right? And Germany started on a very strict level there versus some of the other countries in Europe and beyond, where regulations were quite lax at the beginning and then tightened up. In some ways, they gave us an advantage because we were always playing in the space that is kind of available now worldwide, because regulation everywhere else got tighter and tighter, right? So us focusing on primary homes from the beginning was in that sense an advantage, because it required, quite frankly, a bit more complicated processes, just because you're not only managing guests and repeated guests in one particular apartment, but you were also managing managing the fact that that our customers, our hosts, were coming back every now and then to live in the apartment themselves, or actually quite often and quite frequently. So it was a more cumbersome process, but it made our offering available for a wider market than some international competitors. And actually, they were hit quite hard, some of the international competitors, when, for example, in London, where this is one of the kind of cities with the furthest advanced space in our market. There was no regulation in place in London at all. And then a few years ago, the city capped the number of nights that you could rent out your home through a platform like Airbnb, booking.com, to 90, which completely destroyed a lot of the businesses, because they were focused on investment properties that were available 365 days a year, right? And we never had that shock, because we were quite well prepared to the wider market. That didn't mean that we still didn't have problems with that, because some cities intentionally made it quite tricky to even get to the lower level of now allowed nights per year, for example, when it came to issuing permits and so on. They made it artificially tricky, and that was always a bit of a hurdle, but for us probably in some ways a bit easier, because we were expecting that rather than what international competitors had.
When did you make the decision to expand beyond Germany, and sort of what was the steps that you took in this new country?
Yeah, so the first country we expanded to was Austria and Vienna in particular, and quickly followed by Switzerland as well. And they were both pretty different approaches, because Vienna was our typical urban approach. We went to another city, something we'd done before. In Switzerland, we went to a ski resort. Very different approach. Very, very interesting market, because that particular ski resort we went into, I mean, some of those ski resorts are pretty small, right? But there was about 1,000 holiday homes in that ski resort. And on average, they were occupied for 22 days a year by the owners. So huge amount of time to rent out, right? Really interesting unit economics. And we had no one on the ground there. We partnered with a company that did everything on the ground there for us. So they managed all the keys, they managed all the cleaning and so on. So from a unit economic perspective, this was paradise. This was really, really, really good and interesting. Bit of a harder market to break into, because a super fragmented market with a lot of kind of not the greatest providers there, but entrenched providers that have been doing similar kinds of business for a while. But we thought it'd be really good to break into that market with a new solution, together with the technology to really make it more visible for our customers, for hosts, to see what was going on in their apartment at any given time and so on. But yeah, the approach to Vienna was really interesting because the market was a bit more developed than in a lot of Germany, the short-term rental market. So it was, and Sebastian spoke about acquisition channels earlier, our performance marketing there through Facebook and Instagram was so much cheaper, because people had heard about this before and kind of saw, oh, there's a cool company, established company coming in, they have a good brand, doing good business in Germany, I'll sign up. So the customer acquisition costs there were a lot lower, but also the nightly revenue was relatively low, because there was quite a bit of competition just in terms of the overall supply in the market. But that was still relatively interesting, yeah.
And jumping back to the product, like, I'm sure after you launched it, like, you obviously iterated over time. Like, how did that product evolve once you see people use it and once you add more services on top?
So in terms of the two-sided approach, in terms of the service offering, we stayed relatively close to the initial product in terms of what we do offer, what are absolute must-haves for our customers, as opposed to some nice-to-have things like watering my plants and looking for my mail and all that stuff, which makes it very complex from an operational perspective and doesn't really add a lot of value to the customer at the end of the day, right? So in terms of service offering, again, we stayed relatively close. In terms of the technical product and all things that we solve technically and automated technically in the back end, so to say, we developed quite quickly over time, because as Julie mentioned, everything was manual in the beginning. And when our CTO and the team came in, they were spending a lot of time automating processes, developing the integrations to the service providers we were using, for example, the booking platforms, so that all the workflows could be automated and the customer facing technology, so the front end app that we were developing was looking nice and had all the relevant functionality. So we were developing that over time, adding more functionalities, and it became, of course, user-friendly as we proceeded there.
And yeah, maybe one interesting learning on the services side that you mentioned, we kind of thought, surely our customers want a lot of extra stuff, right? And they want nice frills to go with it, and to be able to as Sebastian says, get some extra services around kind of mail services or whatever if they're away from home, right? And we at some point got quite excited about thinking about that, but then spoke to our customers and quickly realized they really only care about one thing, besides the money, of course. But the one thing was that the apartment is clean when they come back. That was the only thing they cared about. And we had really, really high NPS, but everything that the NPS, whenever someone wasn't super happy, it's because of something related to how clean the apartment was when they came back. Nothing else mattered. And that was quite a good learning to just be like, look, don't ever think of anything on your own. Just ask your customers, right? Or think of something, but really, really quickly go to your customers and ask them, do you think that's necessary? Don't waste more than a day before you get feedback, just to make sure you're not running in the wrong direction.
You mentioned the importance of money, of course, and revenue for them. How did you decide on the pricing? Like, how did you split that with the owners?
That was that's actually one of the things we never changed. We never changed pricing. We had the pricing in place from the first day. And the way it worked for us, because what I mentioned earlier was that we rented out primary homes, right? Like, imagine you go away for a week and then you come back for a week and then you go away for a week again. All the revenue you make through us is incremental revenue, right? It basically doesn't even matter to you, or to many customers, it didn't matter very much what the actual pricing was. They were just happy to get extra money. It's of course a little bit of a question around how you position and how you phrase that and how you communicate that, right? But at the end of the day, we charged 25% of the rental income that was generated, plus a cleaning fee that guests usually pay through platforms like booking.com, Airbnb, and all of that went to us 100%. So in total of the overall booking value, we got about 34-35%, which is quite a lot, because the average booking yielded quite a bit of money, of course, right? But that's nothing that our customers often complained about, because there's basically no alternative in a lot of the cities that we were to us, and because other things were way more important to them. Can we trust them? Do we trust them to manage our home while we're away, right? And price was really secondary, and we had very limited discussions around, please make that cheaper.
I mean, it makes sense. I mean, they're making more money than they would have otherwise, so it's all positive from their side. Yeah.
Exactly. Which is actually one of the reasons we thought about adding extra services, because the way the cash flows worked was the money went into our account from the guests, and we then paid out the money at the end of the month. So it's our customers never had to pay us any money. There was never an invoice sent that said, please send us money. It was the other way around, which creates that nice feeling that you described, Matthias, right? But which also means that what we thought is they'd probably be happy to part with more of that money if we give them extra services, right? We just, instead of sending them the, I don't know, 500, 1,000 euros that they get at the end of the month, we sent them 300 euros and provide them with other services, right? This is kind of the idea that we had in mind, where we thought probably relatively easy to make some more money through cross and upselling, but nothing our customers were really interested in.
You mentioned a good point there also with trust. I mean, how do you build trust?
That is a very good point, and I totally agree 100% with what you're saying. Trust is the number one issue, or the number one aspect that you need to solve when at the end of a selling call, you want someone to give you the keys to their home, right? That was basically the idea of signing up with Airgreets. So we were trying a lot of different things. Of course, you need some initial customers to really test your product, develop your product, and, you know, get those first reviews and customer voices coming in. And this is what we did with our friends and friends of friends, etc., what I mentioned earlier, right? But of course, you also spend a lot of time on building up that brand. So working on reviews that you can get online, that you can really show to customers when they see your ads, when they go to your website. You need to have a very professional website. And then at the end of the day, it's all about delivering what you're promising, right? So what Julie mentioned earlier, if there's a new host coming in, a new customer for us, and he returns from his very first trip, comes back home, and the apartment is not clean, he will never return and be an AirGrid's customer again, right? So you really have to work in order to gain trust. You really have to work on your operations in our case and really make sure those operations work and deliver the value that we promise to our customers, because otherwise we just lose them super quickly. So it's about quality control as well. So we implemented some quality control measures to make sure the apartment is well prepared for the guest. Not so important for the host at the end of the day, unless the review of the guest is very negative. But that is an important element. And then of course, we quality checked quite a lot of cleans that were happening at the apartments. We were of course sending emails, customer surveys to our hosts in order to understand what their NPS is like. Just try to deliver quality as promised.
AirGrid was acquired, I believe, earlier this year in 2020. Could you give a bit of sort of color on how did you get to that? I mean, how did that happen? You know, what was the reason behind you guys to go for that?
Yeah, so we were, where do we start? So we were in a bit of a difficult financial situation, let's put it that way, at the end of the year 2019. So mid of 19, we were looking, you know, we were looking at each other and saying, okay, we need to make it to the next level, right? We are where we are today, but we need to expand. We need to make this a bigger business. And what are potential ways? So we were looking at a bigger investment round on our own. That was one path towards the next level. And the alternative route was basically a consolidation game, because there were other service providers, as Julian mentioned earlier, in other countries, other European countries. So we were not geographically speaking competitors, but we were still doing the same thing basically, just for other markets, but we were developing the same IT, we were setting up the same processes and could learn a lot from each other. So we relatively quickly realized that the own financing round game is not working, primarily because of the market dynamics that Julian was mentioning earlier in terms of regulations. The German or the DACH market simply did not develop as well as other European markets, especially the UK and France. So a lot of the VC money went into companies based out of London and Paris at that time. So we were looking at the consolidation game more, and spoke to a couple of players. And so beginning of December last year, we found ourselves in a bit of a difficult situation where in very, very last minute meetings, our proposed deals didn't materialize, didn't go through board meetings, which put us in a very difficult financial situation end of last year, where we had to find an investor relatively quickly. So we were, at the end of the day, we were able to sell the company end of January this year, which made our AirGrid's journey end on a high note, found a new home for the employees. The idea continued to live on, but from a shareholder's perspective or from a founder's perspective, it was not very interesting for us to remain on board in the long term. And that made our decision making relatively easy to say after 4 years, this was a great ride, and we were also interested in just doing something new.
And just to like cap off the whole like AirGrid story, I'd like to like from each of you just to hear what are your top learnings that you learned through that whole journey, and what would you kind of give as advice to someone who is planning on building their own startup or tech product, kind of stuff like that.
So I can start. I don't want to go into too much AirGrid specifics and be a bit more general. So I think at the end of the day, all of those journeys are all around people, right? So one thing that was mentioned earlier is the founding team and the expertise and experience that you have in that founding team. It's just very, very crucial that everything you need in order to build your product and build your, service or tech or whatever it is, you have some sort of experience in your founding team or a very clear path on how you get that experience on board. That is one thing. And the other thing also related to people is, or the advice I would give to other founders is to surround yourself with people that have been in the startup world, that are in the startup world, that are very well experienced when it comes to entrepreneurship. Every problem that you're facing, you can be sure that someone else has faced that problem before. So I think it's just very relevant to have advisors and have a very good network of entrepreneurs around you outside of your own company that you can always approach when hitting a wall.
Yeah, no, I think that team aspect is right. I think just to add to that, our founding team, we were very similar, right? Which makes some things really easy because you easily agree, right? And things like that. But that's not the name of the game, right? And that's sometimes very counterproductive as well, because you want different opinions, and you need different skills, and bringing that in is quite important, right? I mean, being close friends is of course good, because yes, you're going to fight at some point, and some point is not going to be fun, but you can just be like, well, an hour later it's all good again, right? Because you have that history and you have that relationship. But I think the main thing you should solve for is probably not that comfort, but the complementary skills. I think that's a really, really important one, right? And that's probably the biggest one from my perspective as well. I think the one thing that's always tricky and is always going to be tricky is the question around focus. We spoke about geographic expansion, relatively quick geographic expansion. We spoke about offering several things, right? And what we learned is focus on one product, one offering. Don't spread yourself too thin. Be very, very good at what you're doing. Listen to your customer, iterate, go again, and then build on from there, right? I think those are probably the things that are really important. Oh, one more thing, maybe. I want to add one thing, which I think we weren't so good at, but is absolutely key, is to celebrate all the wins. So because you, especially as someone with big ambitions, we very often only saw what's the next exercise at hand, what's the next step, where do we next need to succeed, right? And never really celebrated the wins enough. I think for us, we did that as a company, but for us, we were probably 10 minutes after the last win, we'd forgotten about that last win and thought about, okay, what's the next goal? Let's get to that next goal, right? And in some ways that's good for the kind of the personal happiness you get out of it. That's sometimes a little bit counterproductive, right? So just being aware of your wins and celebrating them, and taking some time out sometimes, and not always obsessing about how to take it to the next level. I think that's something that that can make you feel quite happy.
Makes sense. Yeah, thanks a lot. I mean, so now the both of you are associate partners at Striper, which is kind of interesting, right? You both joined together. What made you do that? Why did you join together, as well as, you know, why are you interested in working in a venture builder?
So we didn't really join as a team. It just happened to be at the same time or similar times. But Julian is doing business and building up Stripe in the UK, and I'm doing business development for the DACH market. But of course, it's great to have someone you've known for a long time, someone you trust, and, you know, some sort of soulmate in the team as well. From an experience perspective, I think that step makes a lot of sense, because we both worked in consulting firms before and founded our own startup. So the work we're doing at Stripe is really seems to be the perfect combination of those two skill sets, right? So a lot of the work that I've done at the consulting firm was around business development, so understanding needs of corporates, also around topics of innovation, and doing business development for the consulting firm towards corporates, which is exactly what I'm doing at Stripe today as an associate partner. I'm just, well, so to speak, selling a different product that I'm so much more familiar with now, which is venture building, right? And I've built my own venture, I've launched my own startup, I've scaled my own startup. So I really know in depth what I'm talking about when it comes to venture building and proposing that as an innovation vehicle to corporate partners. And this just really makes a lot of sense to me, combining those two skill sets here at Striber, and really, yeah, excites me to take on that new challenge.
Yeah, maybe just one thing to add from my side here. agree with most of what Sebastian said. No, all of what you said, of course.
Thank you.
But just the one thing that I find really exciting about Striver is the stage of the development of the company right now, because it's that perfect combination of Striver has been really successful and has proven that it can do what it's doing very successfully with many of its clients, has built up a great team to draw on and to work with. But now it's kind of about taking it to the next stage, especially for me, who's doing this in a completely new country where I'm on my own so far. But so it's kind of the combination of building something new, but also being in something well established that suits me quite well, again, because of the background as well, right? Because of the combination of the more corporate experience from strategy consulting and also building up a startup. So that's why I'm really excited about it.
Cool. We usually ask for quotes at the end. Do you guys bring some quotes with you to share?
So I didn't bring a quote exactly. I do tend to find quotes a bit cheesy sometimes, yeah. I'm not gonna lie. But I want to share a very, very long quote, a 500-page book that I'd advise everyone to read. I'm not gonna read that out now. But my favorite book in the world is Danny Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but it's basically about heuristics and biases and decision making. That is literally every human on the planet should read this, but definitely every founder on the planet should read this and be aware of it, because it talks a lot about the typical biases that you're faced with as a founder as well, right? So things like confirmation bias. So you see something that confirms your prior view, and you're going to be like, yeah, what I'm doing is right, when that's maybe sometimes not the case, right? Hindsight bias as well, looking at what made Google successful might not be the same thing that makes every other startup successful, right? And kind of using the factors that went along the journey as explanatory variables rather than as mere correlation of the journey, things like that. And he has 1,000 more packed full of great, great stories. Everyone, please read that book. The first 50 pages are super boring, got to get through them, but then you're never going to regret spending that time on reading that book.
Where can our listeners connect with you online?
I guess through LinkedIn. Maybe you can post the profile URLs in your podcast description, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're very active on LinkedIn. So anyone who listens to us, please reach out. Feel free. Always happy to connect and have a chat. And yeah.
Cool.
That's it. Awesome, guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks so much for listening today and for making it to the end of the episode. I hope you learned something. Our theme song is The Vendetta by Stefan Kartenberg. If you want to connect with us or send in your guest recommendations, drop us a line at lunch.learn@gmail.com or connect with Alex or myself on LinkedIn. Otherwise, have a great week, and we'll see you next time on Launch and Learn.